I'm only 97 lifetimes away from that, huh? But this is the way Jesus fed the hungry. All right. This is the way St. Francis had Sister Claire appeared. By saying, when the road from the Ponciuncula to San Damiano is covered with white flowers, that's the day I will allow a woman into the Ponciuncula. And Brother Leo went out and looked, and all he could see was white flowers, and brought them back to him. That's Siddhi consciousness. When the hungry need to be fed, here's the bread, and here's the fish. Even the least among you can do all that I have done, and even greater things. The fact that it's possible for you to do this is one of the things that you have to really examine and really look at in your life and be open to. And the irony is that you have to do it without ego. Because the moment you involve your ego and say, watch, I'm going to do this on the Tonight Show, it's gone. So Sai Baba has this gift. He can manifest vibhuti, which is this holy dust. I have some that has been manifested for me by Sai Baba. Sai Baba appears to me fairly regularly in my dreams. And his appearance is just absolutely real. If you read some of the stories of Sai Baba, and particularly from some of the medical doctors who have been there and in his presence, you'll see that he lives at a higher intuitive level than most of the people on the planet today, probably all of the people. He has devotees from all over the world. When he was asked the question in 1986, on the occasion of his 60th birthday, are you God? He replied, yes, I am. And so are you. He said, the only difference between me and you is that I know it and you doubt it. And it's that knowing that you are connected always to the Father, to God. And when he manifested this vibhuti for me, I have a bag of it about the size of a half an ounce or so. And I give it away, and I always take it with me and put some on my tongue before I speak. And I always have Sai Baba's picture with me in my pocket. And I always feel his energy at any time in my life, particularly in a time when I'm starting to believe that I have problems. And I always go to the visage of this beautiful soul, and the problems seem to just melt away, and the solutions become very obvious. But I've been giving it away since 1993, I believe. When people ask me for it, I give them a little bit of it. And there's still just as much vibhuti there today, 7 years later, as there was in 1993. And that's absolutely true. I had a woman from New Brunswick tell me that when Sai Baba manifested a rose for her, just while she was sitting in the front row like one of you, and just went like this, and there was a rose that he just handed to her. And she took the rose home, and she put it in a vase on her dining room table in New Brunswick. In 1995, it still sits on her dining room table, and every morning it cries vibhuti. Every morning there is dust on her table. There is a consciousness in someone like Sai Baba. And when you're in his presence, and I don't mean in his physical presence, when he is a part of your life, you become directed and guided in ways you never dreamed of before. Sai Baba said, human energy is low, and the divine energy is without limits. You are God. You are the divine energy. When you do the divine work, your energy grows. So again, it's back to that whole idea of that's a spiritual teacher speaking to us about making our energy grow. And here is a scientist whom I've referred to earlier in this program, Valerie Hunt, this divine lady in her mid-80s now, this great teacher who has written about the science of human vibrations and open energy fields in her marvelous book, The Infinite Mind. She said, "We discovered that when a person's field reached higher vibrational states, he no longer experienced material things such as bodies and ego states or the physical world. He experienced knowing, higher information, transcendental ideas, insight about ultimate sources of reality, and creativity in its purest form. All thoughts were grander, more penetrating, and global." This is the kind of changes that you begin to see when you move into higher and faster energy fields. One from a spiritual teacher and one from a scientist. Basically saying, change the frequency at which your life vibrates and at which your thoughts vibrate, and you'll start seeing things in a more penetrating way. You'll start seeing the divineness, divinity, in all things. Valerie said that the one thing that most people are most terrified of is their own divinity, because they've been conditioned and taught to believe that divinity is something that is outside of them, rather than that they are divine creations, that you are not what you have, you are not what you do, you are not what others think of you. You are the beloved. You are the beloved. And as the beloved, you are connected to this highest and divine energy. I want to share one more thing with you. It's from the book that I talked about yesterday, Power versus Force, David Hawkins. And he's talking here about genius and the power of creativity. And when I think of highest frequencies, the word genius applies. And of course, his suggestion is that we're all genius, that human energy, human consciousness, is the consciousness of genius. And it just depends on where you plug into it, whether it's applicable to you or not. This is a very powerful observation and insight of his. He said, "The lifestyle of those whom we term genius is typically simple. Genius is characterized by an appreciation for resources and the economy of ingenuity, because the genius values life and sees the intrinsic worth of all expressions. Inasmuch as time and resources are precious, doing more than necessary is viewed as a waste. Therefore, people of genius often lead very quiet lives and reluctantly sally forth only when there is a cause that must be supported. There is no need to get when you already have. Genius, because it is in touch with an endless source of supply," underline that, "genius, because it is in touch with an endless source of supply, experiences only a minimum of need. Such simplicity seems a common characteristic of true success in general. The basis of this non-materiality, this seeming naivete, is a radical understanding of the nature of the universe itself. That which supports life is supported by life. Survival is thus effortless, and giving and receiving are one and the same thing." That is That is an expression of what I want to talk about here. If you're of the awareness that the universe supports you in the same way that you support the universe, that is, what you put out, the universe also will put out towards you. So that if your attitude is one of give me, give me, give me, ego, 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 mine, 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 I must have, I must have, I must have. If that's your attitude, and a lot of people will say, well, yeah, that's the only way you get things, is by saying, give me, give me, give me. But the irony is that the universe responds to you in the same way that you respond to it. That's what Hawkins was just saying there. So that if your attitude is gimme, 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 the universe's response back to you will be gimme, gimme, gimme. And you will find yourself never arriving and always in this stressful striving, trying to get someplace else, feeling pressured, never ever being able to feel simple and joyful and blissful because you're always having to give back, do something, do more, do more. The pressures that you feel come from what you send out into the universe. On the other hand, if what Hawkins there is saying is true, that when you support life, life supports you, what you put out into the universe puts out to you. And if you shift your internal thoughts from give me, give me, give me, to how may I serve? How may I serve? How may I serve? What are your quotas? What are your quotas? What may I do for you? If you shift to that, the universe's response back to you will be, how may I serve you? How may I serve you? And constantly, wherever you go, you will find the universe wanting to give things to you. And it doesn't come from your saying, I want things from the universe, because the universe will then say back to you, I want things from you. It comes from your saying to the universe and to the world, what can I do for you? How may I serve you? Life supports life in the same way that you put it out there. So the irony of all of this is that when you shift into a how may I serve you mentality, you get all of the things that you used to demand from the universe but never seemed to arrive in a sufficient amount because it was always demanding so much more of you. But the moment that you start serving because it will then serve you, you're doing the gimme, gimme, gimme thing. Does that make sense? So you have to shift and not be attached to what it is that you get. And that's why in A Course in Miracles, there's a wonderful line that is so paradoxical that most people are always asking me about when they read Manifest Your Destiny, which is, infinite patience produces immediate results. Now, how do you deal with that? That's right directly out of A Course in Miracles. And the way I interpret that is that you have to detach from what it is that you want to attract into your life. And when you detach from what it is that you want to attract into your life, you put your energy and your attention on what you do want, and then you let go. And you allow the universe to provide for you what it is that you're willing to give. And infinite patience is just another word, or another term, rather, for knowing. If you have infinite patience, it means that you absolutely know that what you are attempting to manifest and attract into your life is going to show up because you're infinitely patient. I put no time on this, no restrictions. I just know because I have faith. I have faith. Now, what's the immediate result? The immediate result that you get from infinite patience is a sense of peace. A sense of peace. And if I gave you one of those two wands that I talked about before, one which will provide you with all of the physical material things you like, or the other which will give you peace for the rest of your life no matter what comes your way, you all would pick the second wand. Just imagine, there's nothing that can ever get to you again. No matter what comes your way, you're going to be at peace. I mean, who could want any more than that? Infinite patience provides immediate results. It's a detachment awareness. It's like learning to detach. It's really sweet when you finally get it. When you start giving, not because it's something you want to get back. And you know, I've told many of you that I was in Assisi just last week. And while I was there, I just came across a little statue of St. Francis. And it was supposedly blessed by the Franciscan brothers. And it's this beautiful, and I was just really attached to this. And I decided I was going to carry it with me. And here it is, St. Francis with the birds on his arms. And I've been thinking about this lady over here in this wheelchair. And I really would like you to have this. This is from Assisi for you. It's like there's something about you coming here in that damn chair. And I want to give you this, and I don't want anything back for it. You know, there you go. You're very welcome. Just carry it with you. Yeah, that's from St. Francis. Okay. Earlier, I talked about this continuum. And on this continuum from point A to point C, I spoke about our physical health. And represented as such that if you can shift your attention off of trying to get rid of symptoms and instead begin to see yourself as moving to a place of perfect health by shifting the vibrations at which you are energized or living, and begin to see not things as diseases but as energies, and that no matter what it is that you might be dealing with or focusing on in your life in terms of physical impairments or struggles or anything like that, letting in the idea that it is all energy and that the greater danger is not that your hopes are too high and that you won't reach them. It's that they are too low and you will. Keep that in mind. That miracles and healing and getting past those things is not impossible at any time, at any moment in your life. And that even if your body is constrained to a chair or to a crutch or to an absence of vision or whatever, that you, in terms of how you interpret your life, no longer have to see yourself as living between point A and point B. That this is your curriculum to God. And you showed up in a short one, and I showed up in a tall one, and you showed up in a hairy one, and I showed up in a bald one. I think that's a poem, isn't it? And you don't go around saying, this is the wrong body and it shouldn't be this way. You honor it, you accept it, you love it, but most of all, you detach yourself from it. You are not it. It is not you. You are that which notices it. You are the observer to it. On the second element of this continuum is the idea of our emotional health. And that all of the worries, fears, anxieties, stresses, depressions, and all of these kinds of things are representative of lower and slower frequencies. And that what we want to work at is not so much getting rid of our emotional symptoms as to begin to see ourselves as moving towards a place where symptoms are no longer a possibility, because that isn't how I'm going to choose to process and interpret my world any longer. I'm not going to turn the authority of my life over to someone else's behavior or someone else's action and allow myself to be moved and manipulated or immobilized by those reactions or interactions. Until I get to a place at point C in which I'm at perfect emotional health, I am free to experience any emotion, including rage, including joy, bliss, and so on, but I am never choosing to become immobilized or unable to function as a result of other people's actions. One of the questions people ask is, what's the relationship to thoughts and feelings? My feelings come from my thoughts. I control my thoughts. Therefore, I can control my feelings. You don't want to go around in life believing that your feelings are something that just happened to you that you have no control over. Because what I say to you then is, what I want you to do is send those people who are causing you to be upset to me. I will treat them, and you will get better. And you can see the absurdity of that. You have to look at how you are processing and interacting with everyone in your life and begin to make conscious decisions to not allow those people's behaviors, actions, or lack of actions to be the source of my emotional status. It comes from within. It comes from me. And that's perfect emotional health. And we don't all have it all the time. I'm the first to admit that I don't either. There are many people in your life that show up who are great teachers in your life. Many of them are people that you don't get along with. Anybody who can push a button and send you into a frenzy is a great teacher of yours. And those people don't go away. They just keep showing up. They're like a turd that won't flush. They just keep coming back. Keep coming back a little bit more. And the reason they are that is because they are teaching you something in that moment. And what they're teaching you is, you have not yet mastered yourself. And until you have, I'm just coming back. I'm just going to keep coming back. And what does it mean to have mastered yourself? I can choose peace rather than this. I can choose peace rather than this. When I told my daughter Serena when she was 13 years old that I was tired, just tired, of you complaining to me about what kind of a father I am, because she was really good at it, I said, what I want you to do from now on is I want you to take responsibility for the kind of father I have become. She said, I don't get it. And she always stood there with her own little, you know. I said, well, what I know about all of the literature that I have studied in spirituality is that we choose our parents before we even get here. She said, you're trying to tell me that I chose you to be my father? I said, exactly. When did I do this? She said, I don't remember any of this. I said, well, you don't remember what you had for breakfast last Thursday. You don't remember being in a crib. You don't remember being in mommy's tummy. But all of those things happen. Just because you don't remember it doesn't mean that it's true. I said, you just got to trust me on this one. Before you even showed up here, you had an option. You had lessons to learn, and you needed certain parents to get here. That's how you get here. And you picked mom to be your mom, and you picked me to be your father. So you're telling me, this is exactly the way she talks, only it's with a lot of likes. Like you're telling like me? I said, yep, like I'm telling like you. That before I even, got here, that I was like choosing like you to be like my father? I said, like, yeah. She said, I must have been in a hurry. I said, well, like, you've got to, like, start being, like, more responsible about, like, the choices you're, like, making, you know? And she has always been a great teacher of mine. She came home from school one day, and she said, you were on television yesterday. I said, yeah. She said, you were on Oprah Winfrey. She said, there were people in the school talking about that. She said, you didn't tell me you were going to be on Oprah. I said, well, she called and I went. I didn't ask your permission. I just went. She said, they were talking on there in the class. The teacher was talking that you actually wrote a book. About how to raise children. I said, yes, I did. It's called What Do You Really Want for Your Children? She said, tell me it isn't true. You couldn't have written a book about how to raise children. That's my daughter. I once said to Stephanie, who was, when she was 13 or 14 years old, would you like to come and hear me speak? I said, people actually pay to hear me talk. She said, why? Don't they have a life? That's it. Her greatest line ever was when we had to tell her once more that that mom was pregnant, because my wife had 5 children in 8 years. And when we had to tell her that the 5th one was coming, and she was in the, I think, the 7th grade, she said, how do you think it feels? I said, well, you know, we're blessed and we're able to afford it, and you're lucky that we had a different attitude when we found out about you. than you have about this, but we're actually very, very happy and very thrilled. We're very blessed, and it's a surprise to us, too. A surprise. Right. She said, how do you think it feels to be the only kid in junior high school who has parents who like to do it? So they're great, I'll tell you. These are all your teachers. All of them. And the more difficult it is to be in their presence and the more grief that they give you, the more important it is that you understand that these people who push your buttons, and I do it in a humorous way, but you can also look at the relationships that you're in and the people that keep pushing those buttons and keep showing up and they're on a daily basis. They're not there by accident, because nobody is. They're going to stay until you get it. And then once you get it, it won't matter whether they stay or not. And once it doesn't matter whether they stay or not, you'll be enjoying their company. Or they'll be gone, like a play, because your life is like a play. And there are so many acts that have to be played out, and there are so many characters that are in the play. And some come in for the opening act. And sometimes they stay for act two. Or maybe even act three. And then they depart. Some stay for 4, 5, and 6 acts. Every one of these people have a role to play. And the amount of time that that role is played out is all just a part of the play. And once you get that and understand that, then you no longer attach yourself. And attachment is a very powerful, important part of all of this. So that's emotional health. But what I want to talk about now is consciousness on this continuum of A, B, and C. A, B, and C. And what I was saying there about all of these teachers Once you can see them, once you see the little lady driving in front of you who's hoping for the light to change so she can stop, as there, not to annoy you, but as your teacher, to see if you can accept her without being annoyed. And in fact, if you can reach divine consciousness where you can celebrate and send her love for being there and thank her for slowing you down. Thank her for slowing you down. Then you'll have moved from low to high, from slow to fast frequencies. That's what it's about. It's so simple, but that's a perfect example. And whoever they are, wherever they are out there, if you can slow down and say thank you. Yesterday I walked from here to the place where I'm staying. It's about 2.5 miles. And in the walk after the day of speaking to you, which was deliriously, wonderfully fulfilling for me, it always is to do this. I love this. I think I saw 9 deer with white tails stop looking at me. I saw a little chipmunk get killed on the way there. It went, ran across the street. It ran back. It got a car came by. It didn't know which way to go. And I went over there, and I thought the emotion of these deer just running through the woods, just freely jumping and leaping. It was so beautiful. And then to see this little chipmunk give up his life. And then I watched, and I stood there sort of saying a little tiny prayer over this chipmunk whose guts had been spilled out on the road. A crow came by and flew over and landed and started eating the remains of the chipmunk. And I thought, it's a food chain. The crow has to eat. The chipmunk was here to provide for that crow. The crow will become someone else's meal, or will become fertilizer to grow some other food that something else can graze on. It's like it's this, and there was just, it was like selling my cleverness, as Rumi said, and purchasing bewilderment. There was all these adventures and this little walk down the road, looking at the leaves changing at this time of year, hearing things but not knowing what they are. Have you done that in the woods out here? All of a sudden you'll hear, what the hell is that? Is that a snake? Is that a raccoon? Is that a fox? What is it? We saw a silver fox on the way in here. A beautiful fox running across the road looking up at the lights. It's like you purchase bewilderment. And you begin to see everything in a different light. Everything. And you know, the same bewilderment can be experienced and enjoyed and processed in the city and in your home and in your bedroom and sitting on your couch and in your car, anywhere. You can look for the beauty. You can look for all of the miracles that are around it, or you can be looking for all the things that are wrong. And again, it's if you put your attention on what's wrong, then your energy goes down. If you put your attention on the problem magnifies. If you put your attention on the solution, on what is right, and what you love, and how phenomenal this moment is, that will be your experience of life. And the great masters go through life and see everything like that. As Whitman said to me, every cubic inch of space is a miracle. You don't look for miracles. You live one. Now, as consciousness on this level, there are 3 places. One is point A, which is the lowest level of consciousness. And throughout this program, I have been talking about this level of consciousness and how to overcome it. This is called ego consciousness, point A. Ego consciousness is the consciousness in which we identify ourselves on the basis of our personalities, our achievements, our accomplishments, our reputations, and we begin to see the world in terms of our separateness from each other, therefore we are in competition with, in terms of our separation from what we would like to create in our lives, what we would like to have in our lives. We see ourselves as separate from it, whether it's money, whether it's the stuff we want or the people we would like to have in our lives, we're separate from it. And separate from God. God is that which is outside of me. That's what divinity is. It's out there somewhere. It's usually a person, usually a male, usually a white male, in the sky with a beard and with a scepter and with a, and that's somehow there's this invisible vision of God as that which is separate from me out there, and that's ego consciousness. And I've spent enough time speaking about ego consciousness. It's the lowest and slowest frequency. And then point B is called, or what I call, group consciousness. And this is a higher level of consciousness than ego consciousness, but it's still a very low. Point B is always ordinary levels of awareness. It's being ordinary. As Dan Millman concluded in his The Way of the Spiritual Warrior, when the seeker was told to go out onto a rock and sit there until he had a profound thought. And he would sit there and come back and he'd try one, and Socrates, his teacher, would say, "Now, it's not profound. Go back. Go back to the rock 24 hours, come back. No, that's not profound." He sat there for days. And finally he came to Socrates and gave him an idea. And he said, "Yes, now you've got it." And his thought was, "There are no ordinary moments. There are no ordinary moments." He said, "That's profound." But most of us live at ordinary levels of awareness. We see the ordinariness of it. Group consciousness is one in which we say to ourselves, "I am the groups that I belong to, that I was born into. And my allegiance is to those groups that are separate from those other groups." Okay? So I was born on this side of the river, and you were born on that side of the river. Therefore, I am your enemy. And I must therefore be trained to fight you and to kill you in the name of patriotism. And this is what is right. My skin color is this. Your skin color is that. I have an allegiance to my race. And my first allegiance is to that physical appearance that I have. And I will fight and die for my race. I am male. You are female. I'm from Mars. You're from Venus. All right? Whatever. I remember John Gray and I toured Australia together. And he spoke every morning and I spoke every afternoon for 2 weeks throughout Australia and New Zealand. And every morning he went out there and told the people how the men were from Mars and the women were from Venus. And I went out there in the afternoon and said that we're all one. It's just an artificial distinction. So there's a lot of confused people in Australia, I think. I am young, you are old. I am conservative, you are liberal. I am Republican, you are Democrat. I am of this persuasion. I am Muslim, you are Jewish. I am Catholic, you are Protestant. I live in the North, you live in the South. It's all of these dichotomies. It's all of these divisions. It's all of these groupings. And we have really come to a place in our hearts where we actually start to believe this stuff, that we are whatever group we've been assigned to. Instead of seeing ourselves as connected, we see ourselves still as connected, but only connected to a certain number of us. And those certain number of us have to meet certain criteria. You have to take an oath of allegiance. You have to swear to uphold this constitution. of this country, the greatest country in the world. And wherever you go, you hear everybody saying that. And then when someone says, wait a minute, you're the greatest country? We're the greatest country. Well, we'll have to solve this. And then we have wars. And group consciousness is the source of all conflict on the planet in terms of wars, the identification with a particular group. It all just keeps evolving. It all just keeps changing and shifting. I remember a story of a president of a university having to deal with the Afro-American student body population who were making demands on him to have their own dining hall. And finally he gave in and said, look, if the Afro-American students want to eat in their own separate dining hall, we'll give them their own separate dining hall. They have a right to that. And they gave them that, and then the Afro-American League came to them and said, but we want our own sororities and our own fraternities. And they had all kinds of discussions and committee meetings, and finally they decided, okay, this is not an unreasonable request. We'll give you your own fraternities and sororities. Then they said, well, we would like our own curriculum. We would like to have people studying Afro-American history so that they will have pride in their own race. And they discussed it and debated it and went to the curriculum committees and back and forth. And finally they decided, okay, we'll create a curriculum for the... And then they decided they wanted their own dorms, that we should have a place where we can stay because we're most comfortable here. And the sororities, they fought and they had their own dorms. And then finally they were in a meeting and the representative from the Afro-American community came to them on the campus and handed him a note. And he looked at the note and he said, oh no, he said, not that. Not that, please. And everyone said, what is it? What do they want? He said, they want their own drinking fountains. And what does that tell us? We're going right back to the very thing that we hated the most, the separation. We are now taking on the same consciousness of slavery that enslaved us, of separation that separated us. That somehow we've got to find a way to get past group consciousness. I wrote an essay about it in Wisdom of the Ages from a poem by Stephen Crane, called Do Not Weep, Maiden, War is Kind. I'm not going to read it here because it's too long, but it really is one of those ironic poems that talks about how people are raised to believe that dying on the battlefield is a noble thing to do. And fighting for your country and fighting for your causes and fighting for your race and fighting for your liberalism or fighting for your religion is noble. And it may be more noble than fighting for your ego, but it still is another form of separation and low and slow energy on the planet. Point C, on the consciousness scale, is called unity consciousness, God consciousness. It's a place in which we have moved away from separation to connection. And all of those things I talked about early in this program that constitute spirit and spiritual energy, connectedness, cheerfulness, love, infinity, all of these qualities comprise the essence of unity consciousness. Unity consciousness is represented by the poem that John Donne, the metaphysical poet of the 16th century, no man is an island, entire of himself. Every man's death diminishes me. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. It tolls for thee. And Rumi, this great love poet of the 13th century, who's having a resurgence now, once said, I You? Me? He? She? They? These are distinctions which do not exist in the garden of the mystics. Here we're speaking about mystical consciousness. Here we understand that this is a round planet. And on a round planet, there's no choosing up sides. We're all one. We breathe the same air. We drink the same water. Our bodies are warmed by the same sun. We eat the same food. And there is no separation. I have looked at the difference between the attitudes, if you will, of the higher and the lower self. And I've just divided them into six categories. This lower, if you will, ego and group consciousness thinks in terms of comfort and conveniences for the body. The higher consciousness attitude thinks in terms of psychological and spiritual well-being. You move beyond yourself as a body, as a thing, as a material, and you move into an awareness of just well-being for yourself and for others. Second, the lower frequencies see themselves as the center of the universe. I am the center of the universe. My group is the center of the universe. And when you go to the Middle East, and when you go to Ireland, and when you go to places around the planet where there are conflicts, and you speak to the people in one particular group, whether it's in Northern Ireland or whether it's in the Gaza City, or whether it's in Jerusalem, or whether wherever it might be, whether down in Indonesia, or wherever these conflicts occur, the people on their side are convinced that they are the center of the universe and the rightness is in my cause. And they've been conditioned and trained to believe that and to die for it. Whereas the higher unity consciousness self sees itself as one cell in this body called humanity. And in this cell, in this body called humanity, if one cell is in a state of cooperation with the other cells, distinctions and separation. And what is a judgment? What I understand about judgment is that when you judge another person, you do not define them. You define yourself as someone who needs to judge. Just because you define me as stupid doesn't make me stupid. It makes you a person who has to define others as stupid. I have to define myself. So judging others is really just a form of your own self-judgment. And true nobility is really not about being better than anyone else. It's about being better than you used to be. It's just about being better than you used to be. And all I know for myself for sure is that I'm not better than anyone else listening here, but I know that I'm better than I used to be. In every human regard, I know I'm better than I used to be. Because I'm growing. And the only difference between a flower that's alive and one that's dead is the one that's alive is growing. And the one that's dead is not. Whereas the higher, if you will, frequencies make discernments and strive for unity and oneness. Unity and oneness. Five, the lower self operates under the law of aggression. That is, I have to get mine before you get mine. And I know you're after what my piece of the pie. I know you're trying to get it. Because there's only so much out there. There's a limited supply. And I have to go after it. And if I have to be aggressive in order to get it, then I will. And as you saw when we did the demonstrations with the kinesthesiology, that aggression always makes us weaker. And the higher consciousness, higher spirit, operates under the law of love. Simply love. And love always strengthens you. Always. And finally, the lower self has a competitive nature. The lower frequencies have a competitive nature, while the higher frequencies have a cooperative nature. Cooperative nature. So, this is unity consciousness. It's a place in your life that when you begin to reach here, when you begin to calibrate at faster and higher frequencies, you begin to see yourself as a piece of humanity and connected to God. And when you see other people, see, I was trained by a great teacher whose name is anonymous to always address people you don't know by name with a label of respect. So that if someone comes up to you and asks you for something, for an autograph or for whatever it might be, and you don't know their name, you either say, yes, sir, or no, ma'am. Always. Now, you don't do this because it's polite. You don't do it because it's mannerly, because it's the right thing to do. And I resisted this at first, but my ego was in the way. Now I don't resist it at all. Even if it's a 12-year-old boy asking me something, I say, yes, sir. Because I was taught to remember that you are not addressing the person or the appearance or the body. You are addressing the unfolding of God. That's what you're addressing. The spirit that you share with this person. And when you address that spirit, it always deserves some kind of a term of respect from you. So use that as a reminder that every time you do it, this is what you're noticing. The first day that I ever met Deepak Chopra, maybe 12, 13 years ago, when I walked up to him, he put his hands together and he bowed. This is not the normal greeting that I get from physicians in this country. Frequently I get a half a peace sign, all right? That's what I call that. And when he put his hands together and he bowed, he said, Namaste. Namaste. And it's a Sanskrit word that means I celebrate in you the place where we are both one. It's nice to have a word for that instead of, excuse me, I celebrate the place in you where we're both one. Oh, really? Well, I celebrate the place in you where you are both one, too. Namaste. It's a recognition of the greatness that is in, or the divinity, or the genius, or the unfolding of God that is in everyone. And it's a constant reminder to stay there. And it's particularly effective in dealing with people who are supposed to be, by their roles and their appearances, serving you or subservient to you in some way. The waiter, the maid in the hotel, the hostess on the airplane, the flight attendant, the person who takes your bags at the when you check them in at the airport, the person who is cutting your grass for you, or washing your clothes for you, or sweeping the streets for you, or collecting the garbage that you leave behind. It's particularly relevant to address the unfolding of God in everyone, even those who are angry at you or you have been taught are your enemies. It's particularly relevant to send those people a greeting of respect and love. And I was told a wonderful story by a man I admire enormously. His name is Ram Dass. He has appeared here in Omega on many occasions. He's exactly 10 years older than I am. Many people think we're brothers because we look alike. And he told this story, it's got to be 30 years ago. It's a story that the first time I told it to my buddy, Deepak Chopra, he laughed out loud. And Deepak doesn't always get my humor. I remember the first time that he appeared on Oprah with his book, Ageless Body, Timeless Mind. And it just skyrocketed. It just took off. He had a wonderful experience. I was watching it in Hawaii, and I called him up, and I said, Deepak, I said, it's fantastic. It's great. I said, Oprah called me. He said, what? I said, yeah, she called me, and she told me that she really is no longer interested in this character that she's been living with, and that she's now totally, completely in love with you. Not only is she in love with you, but she told me if there was any chance, she would really like to spend the rest of her life with you and marry you. And he was on the other end of the phone going, I do not understand what you were talking about. Why would Oprah say that? He said, I said, Deepak, she just said to me she thought the idea of being Oprah Chopra was as good as it gets. And then he laughed and he thought that was great. But some people, when I tell this story that Ram Dass told, don't get it at all. So as you're listening, some of you will think it's hilarious, and some will not get it at all. But it is a story that symbolizes and represents this level of consciousness that I'm addressing here in this program, unity consciousness. It seems that there was a shepherd who lived at this level of 100,000 cycles per second consciousness, unity awareness. And if you remember what I read from Hawkins' book about genius, that this is always a simple life. A life of non-pursuit. When you have it, you don't seek it. When you have it, it seeks you. But because you're not seeking it, even when it seeks you, you just let it pass. So that it just seems to flow through you rather than something you hang on to. It's like trying to grab a hold of the water in the stream, and the tighter you squeeze, the less you get to experience the stream. But when you let go and just let your hand be in the stream and appreciate the flowing of it, you get to experience it. Squeeze, it's gone. Flow, you know it. And this was a man who lived at that level, but he was a simple man and he was a shepherd. And someone from the West approached this shepherd, someone who was, let's say, not at 100,000 cycles per second, maybe 20. And he said to the shepherd, he said, that's a fine flock of sheep you have there. He said, could I ask you a few questions about your sheep? And the shepherd said, why, of course. He said, well, he said, how far do your sheep walk every day? The shepherd said, I can't answer that question unless you tell me which ones you're talking about. The white ones or the black ones? Well, he said, I was thinking of the white ones. He said, well, the white ones walk 4 miles every day. The man said, He said, and what about the black ones? He said, oh, the black ones also walk 4 miles. The man was a little perplexed. He said, He said, well, can you tell me, he said, how much food would your sheep eat in any given day? And he said, well, in any given day, I can't answer that unless you tell me which ones you're speaking about. The white ones or the black ones? He said, well, the white ones. He said, well, the white ones eat 2.5 pounds of grass every single day. We've measured that. He said, oh, he said, that's amazing. He said, and what about the black ones? He said, the black ones eat 2.5 pounds also. He said, wow, he said, that's amazing. But He said, well, let me ask you one more question. He said, at shearing time in the spring, how much wool do your sheep give? And again, the man said, well, I can't answer it unless you keep asking me these questions, but you don't make the distinctions. He said, are you speaking about the white ones or the black ones? He said, okay, the white ones. He said, well, the white ones give 6 pounds of wool every year at shearing time. And the man said, don't tell me. He said, what about the black ones? He said, well, the black ones give 6 pounds of wool also. Finally, the man from the west couldn't take it anymore. And he said, look, he said, I just don't understand you. He said, every time I ask you a question about your sheep, you divide them into the white ones and the black ones, and then you tell me that they're exactly the same. What is with that? And the man said, oh, he said, that probably is confusing. He said, I can explain that. He said, you see, I've been working as a shepherd for many, many years, and I've saved up all of my money. And he said, you see all of those sheep out there? He said, you see the white ones out there? He said, yes. He said, well, those are mine. He said, I purchased them, I own them, I've raised them, and those are all my sheep. Oh, he said, I see. He said, well, who owns the black ones? He said, I do. And that's the story. Isn't that a great story? I love that story. So it's very important for us to make these distinctions, but in the end, we're all one. We're all one. What we believe becomes our method, if you will, of raising our energy. How we think. You've seen it demonstrated. You know that a thought creates a reaction. And the thought, all the thought has to be is on a knowing. And it doesn't make any difference whether the scientific community agrees with it or disagrees with it or thinks that it's right or doesn't. If you have a knowing that you can get rid of snoring, and that's where you put your attention, snoring will disappear from your life. And so will anything else if you do it with infinite patience and that knowing. And I want to tell you a story that was told to me by a minister as I was speaking for a conference in Austin, Texas a few years ago. He was a southern minister. And I was surprised at his story. And it really is sort of illustrative of what I've been speaking about and what I'd like to go into right now. Seems that there was a minister, and he was giving a sermon on Easter Sunday. And he noticed that in his congregation, there was a woman, her name was Marjorie. She was 92 years old, and she hadn't been in church for several months. In fact, she hadn't been there since the fall. And so he decided, since she lived out in the rural parts of the congregation, that he would go out and visit and see if she was all right, because she lived alone. That afternoon, after the service, he drove out and he knocked on the door, and Marjorie came to the door, as bright and happy and alive and healthy as a woman of 92 could be to him. She offered him some tea and some biscuits, and they talked and chatted, and he noticed as he looked around her home that it was filled with antiques. It had a lot of colonial furniture, had old colonial pottery. It had an old pump organ. You know those old pump organs where the pipes go up the wall? And everywhere he looked, he could see these beautiful ancient antiques. And he started walking around when she was in the kitchen, and he would look over here at this, and he looked at a little bowl, a pottery bowl, and it was sitting on top of that old pump organ. And he looked again, and it was filled with water. He didn't want to say anything, and he came and sat down, and they talked. And then when she got back into the kitchen, he walked over, and he looked at it, and sure enough, it was filled with water, and it had a condom floating in it. He went back and he was sat down, and again, when he had an opportunity, he just walked around and looked. And sure enough, that was a condom floating in that antique bowl on that old pump organ. And then he finally, when he was leaving, he didn't want to embarrass her, and he didn't want to really ask, but his curiosity really got the best of him. And finally, he said to her, he said, "Marjorie, I'm really happy that you're feeling well, that you'll be back in church next Sunday." She said, "Well, the roads have cleared now." She said, "I can drive and get there." He said, "That's wonderful. It's been great visiting with you. Thank you for your hospitality." He said, "By the way," he said, "what is that over there?" He said, "I've looked at it." She said, "That? Oh." She said, "I'll tell you what that is." She said, "It's a miracle. That's what it is." He said, "A miracle?" She said, "Absolutely." He said, "Well, in what way?" "Well," she said, "last fall," she said, "I thought I was selling the farm. I really thought it was over for me. I was very sick. And I was out walking on the property, and I came across this package. And I picked up the package, and I looked at it, and I took out my glasses, and I read it. And it said very clearly, 'For the prevention of disease, keep moist and place on your organ.'" She said, "I haven't been sick all winter." So you don't have to really listen to what the establishment tells you is the right or the wrong thing to believe in. All you have to do is put your attention on being well and use anything you want. Isn't that a great story? Now, I'd like to speak about, for a few moments, about why it is that people are unable to manifest and attract into their life what they want. What are the things that keep them from being able to reach these higher, faster frequencies I've been speaking about so much here? And essentially, it boils down to something quite simple. As you think, so shall you be. It's what Earl Nightingale called the strangest secret. It was the first million-selling tape ever, published back in the 40s and 50s. The strangest secret. You become what you think about all day long. I tell it to my children all the time. When little Seiji was studying for her spelling tests, and I showed you some of her spelling in some one of these earlier tapes, and she had been convinced that she was not a good speller. The only two words she got wrong on her spelling test were Sky and Summer, her two sisters, S-K-Y-E and S-O-M-M-E-R. And she went and fought for the right to have those right, because that's how her sister's names are spelled. She said, "It's your fault that I'm not a good speller." Anyway, when she changed schools, and she, I said to her, I said, "Honey," I said, "it's time for you to change your belief about yourself as a speller." I said, "You become what you think about." Say it. "I know." "You become what you think about." I said, all day long, "What do you think?" "I'm a great speller. I'm a great speller." Just keep saying it and saying it. And when you say that, then you'll act upon that thought. And when you do, we'll go over your spelling words together. And we'll go over every single one of them. And she has had 100% on every spelling test this semester so far. And every time I say to her, "Well, how come you're getting 100%? She said, "Because you become what you think about all day long." I know. I was like, she's 10 years old. She's got to do her little dorky things, right? But the fact is that you can apply this anywhere. You do become what you think about. And the irony of what you think about is that it works in either direction. So that if you think about what you would like to attract into your life, and you do it with what I call the four reallys, and I have put out tapes with Hay House on this, how to get what you really, 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 really want. In fact, Deepak Chopra and I put out a two-cassette tape on that, which is very fascinating, very interesting, and very funny. It's really a live presentation the two of us made interacting on this whole idea. And essentially, the four really stand for what you ask, what you wish for. It starts with a desire. What you ask for, what you intend to create, with passion. Those are the four reallys. What you wish for, ask for, intend, and have passion about, you will attract into your life. That's what manifestors do. They first start with, I would like to have this. Then they ask, would you please cooperate with me in providing me with the ability to create and manifest this into my life? I'm asking. I intend to create it. So there's no longer a, I hope that it happens. There's an intention about it. And you don't ever allow any other thoughts in. If people say, yes, but don't you understand, it's very difficult to attract this into your life. It's very difficult to get this kind of a job. Yeah, but you can't really make this kind of money. Yes, but this isn't going to work out. All of these kinds of things are, you say, okay, I understand that, but you don't let your energy field become contaminated, and you just simply respond, not to them, but to yourself, I understand all of that, but I intend to manifest this into my life. I intend to do so. And eventually, you will act upon it. It's like if you want to quit smoking, or if you want to quit drinking, or if you want to lose weight, or if you want to overcome an addiction of some kind, what you do is you just keep your intention on it. Forget your behavior. Forget the fact that you're still drinking. Forget the fact that you still overeat. Forget the fact that you're still smoking. Let all of that go. Just create an intention. I wish for, I ask for your guidance, God, in providing me with the strength that I was born with to do this, and now I intend to create it. I intend to do it. And even though you're still smoking, even though you're still doing the drugs or overeating or whatever, I intend to create it. Eventually, you see, the fact of continuing to do it is part of the process of changing it. So instead of telling yourself I shouldn't be doing this and filling yourself with what? Shame and guilt, which does what? Always weakens you, always brings you down, and makes you more of a victim of your own abuse. Instead, you just say, okay, there he goes again, lighting up another cigarette. No, there he goes again. He's going to eat that hot fudge sundae, even though he knows that his cholesterol is too high. There, watch, look at him. And you become the observer, the noticer. And eventually, as you keep that process going, you'll find yourself one day saying, that's it. That's how I quit drinking. I just let it go one day. I watched and observed, and I said, you know, you have two or three beers every day after you run, every night. And I tried to think of a day when I didn't have one, and it had been 10 years. When I had gone without drinking, two or three beers in the evening. Not drunkenness, not any of that kind. Just two or three beers, sometimes four, in the evenings after running. It was all, And I thought about it, and then it's just the day came when I just said, okay, my intention is now that that's not what I want anymore. I'm just not going to have one today. That's it. I'm just not going to have one today. And I didn't. And that was over 10 years ago. And I still haven't had a day. And so I call myself a camel. A camel is an animal who starts out every day on his knees, which I do. And he ends every day on his knees, which I do. And he can go 24 hours without a drink. And that's what I do. And I don't say to myself, I'll never drink again. I'm just not going to have one today. Today's a day that I'm not interested in having one. And that's how you live your life. You become what you think about. So if you think about it, there's nobody who's ever quit smoking who didn't think about it for a long time. There's nobody who's ever lost the weight that they wanted to get rid of who didn't think about it for a long time. Thinking about it is part of the process. But you don't want to think about it with shame, because then you'll weaken yourself and you'll continually go back, because addictions are defined as never getting enough of what you don't want. So eventually you just get to a point where you say, okay, that's fine. I think today I'll run, and that's what happened with me in 1976. I said, I think I'm going to run around the lake. It was in Minneapolis, Lake Harriet. And I said, I'm just going to see if I can run around the lake. Well, I ran 100 yards. And I was 36 years old, and I couldn't run 100 yards or more without getting out of breath. And then the next day I said, you know, I wonder if I can do that again. I wonder if I can run. And the next day I ran 100 yards without getting out of breath. 4 days later, 4 days, that's how fast your body responds to your thoughts. 4 days later, I ran around the lake, 2.2 miles or whatever it is, around the lake. Not very fast, but I was able in 4 days to overcome almost 20 years of inactivity, or 15 years of inactivity from running. And today, I run marathons. You know, it's not, and I still run every day. virtually every day. There have been a few days now because my wife challenged me a few years ago. She said, I think I would be more impressed if you didn't run one day. I don't think you cannot run in a day. That pisses me off. But it had been over 20 years since I'd missed a day of running. And I just said one day, I'm not running today. And I ran. And a year later, I said, I'm not running. This is the day I'm not going to run. And I ran. And not too long ago, I said, it's time for me to prove that I don't have to be addicted either way. And I didn't run. And now I still run 99.9% of the days, but I also know that I cannot run. I'm free to be whatever it is that I want to be. So you become what you think about. And as you put these thoughts out into the world and you watch yourself still continuing with your addictions, you send yourself love. You surround yourself with love. And you say, you know, you're entitled to this Sunday. You're entitled to this cocaine. You're entitled to this marijuana. You're entitled to whatever it is. And I am not going to shame you. I'm not going to feel bad about you. I'm not going to be upset with you. And I'm going to help you to create your intention. I'm going to help you to do it. And it will get easier and easier because with God, all things are possible. And that leaves nothing out. And I know that the worst crack cocaine addict in the inner city of any large city in the world can, in a moment, transcend it and overcome it. Absolutely know it. And when the student is ready, when you're ready to manifest what you want in your life, when you're really ready and you say, God, I am willing to turn it over to you. I'm willing to accept any guidance, any help that you are willing to send me. I now start becoming open to the teachers who are going to show up in my life. And they'll show up in the form of a little child. I had a woman tell me one day that her 10-year-old daughter came home with a girlfriend. And the little girlfriend said to her daughter, I didn't know your mommy was fat. And she said, that was my teacher. I'd been thinking about how tired I was of being overweight for all of these years and carrying around this extra and all of the, I'd just been tired of the baggage. And this little child who just came into my house for the first time said it. She said, I went out, I lost the weight, I knew what I had to do. And it was gone. She said, I've never put it back on since. I had another woman who was diagnosed with cancer. And she was told that she had metastasized and that she didn't have much of a chance to live. And she decided that she wasn't going to go through traditional treatments. And she went to she didn't tell her family. She just said, she gathered them and said, she said, I have to do something alone. And you have to allow me to do it. And she rented a cabin in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, I can't remember which. And she went away and she just decided to meditate every day, the whole day, and to get quiet and to commune with God and to just let her body be away from all of the pressures that she felt at home with all of the things with her large family and her husband who wasn't working and so many things that were pressurized in her life. And she just meditated every day and she would go for walks in the woods and she went for a week and then 2 weeks and then 3 weeks and then she stayed there a month. And she stayed there for 8 months in the wilderness. And in that entire 8 months' time, she began to get closer and closer to God, the silence, the indivisibleness of it. And in that silence, she came home, and she's still today cancer-free. I don't know that that's everybody's answer, but for her, it was. And when I think of sitting in Nelson Mandela's cell on Robben Island off the coast of Cape Town in March of this year, and I realized that that man went into silence because he was forced to by a government who was imposing apartheid racial laws. And here was a person who was a lawyer who was taken from his law practice and put onto this prison, into this island, which was a prison. And in this forced solitude and his requirement to be in silence when he wasn't even allowed to be photographed or talk to anybody else. He came out in 1990. I was there on the exact 10th anniversary of his coming out. And all he had in his heart was forgiveness and reconciliation. That's all he brought out there, because he had gone and met God in his silence. And he became the statesman of the century, certainly one of them. Transformed not only apartheid in South Africa, but in all of Africa, and became a symbol. Here was a man who, when he went into prison, was in a country that was so restrictive that all you had to do was attend a meeting and you could be in prison for the rest of your life. And he came out, and he was the democratically elected president of that country with almost no violence 4 years from his departure from the prison. That's astonishing. It's astonishing. That kind of consciousness, when you get quiet and go within and ask and then intend. And to this day, he serves as a wonderful, powerful symbol of how you do literally transform the world. So it works in terms of what you want. And then it also works in terms of what you don't want. What you really, 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 really don't want, you will also get. And this is one of the most difficult things for people to grasp and understand. That if you become what you think about all day long, and what you think about all day long is what you don't want or what you don't like, you will act upon what you don't want, because you can only act upon your thoughts. And what you don't want will continue to show up and manifest into your life. You cannot manifest thin from "I hate being fat." Because if you hate being fat, your attention, your energy is on hating being fat. And you will then create more hating being fat into your life. You cannot manifest abundance from "I despise being poor." Because the despising of being poor is your thought, you will attract more despising of being poor into your life. You'll have to act upon what you think about. And it gets worse. You cannot attract into your life what you want if your thoughts are on what is. That is, if you put your attention and your energy on the circumstances of your life, and you despise the circumstances of your life, and that's what you think about all day long, are these circumstances that I don't like, you will attract more of the circumstances of your life, because that's where your thoughts are. You have to shift your thoughts off of "what are the circumstances of my life" onto "what circumstances I intend to manifest," and keep them there. And every time your thoughts go back to what you don't want or what the circumstances of your life are, you immediately realize that you are now going into point A or point B on one of those three scales that I've described here in this program. You have now weakened yourself and you have weakened your life. So you shift into, this is what I intend to create, and you get a picture of it, a visualization of it, and you act upon that vision. Even if you notice that your body isn't cooperating and it's still doing the things that it was doing before, your thoughts are on, body still wants to do that. Okay. Still wants to lay in bed when it knows it should be out walking. Okay. But my thoughts are on, I intend to create a healthy body. And then the next time, and the next time, and before you know it, you'll become a camel. You'll go 24 hours without a drink. Or you'll use that 24 hours to exercise or whatever. You have to, because it's the law of the universe. Don't get mad at me. I'm just a reporter. I'm just reporting the way it is. This is what you think about. The spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. It's the spirit that gives life. St. Paul said, "That which is seen hath not come from that which doth appear." The source of everything over here in the physical world is not over here. The source is in a thought. It's in the world of spirit. and it gets worse. You cannot attract or manifest into your life what you want if your thoughts are on what always has been. And that's the wake. And that's your personal history. If you don't have a story, you don't have to live up to it. And if your thoughts are on what always has been, and you use this as a reason why you can't attract into your life what you want, because after all, it's always been this way, then even if you are really angry at the way it's always been, and your thoughts are on how angry you are at the way it always has been, what it always has been will continue to show up in your life because you become what you think about all day long. So you don't look and put your attention on what always has been, you give that up. And again, you shift not just to what you want, because if your thoughts stay on just on what you want, then you'll create and manifest more of wanting. What you want to do is put your attention on what you intend to create with passion, as long as it's motivated out of love and kindness and all of the things that will produce strength, which is between 20,000 and 100,000 cycles per second. Love, kindness, forgiveness, the things I'm going to summarize with. And it gets even worse, believe it or not. And this is the toughest one of all. You cannot manifest or attract into your life what you want if your thoughts are on what they want for you. Now, you may really be very upset about what they tell you they want for you. And there's no shortage of they. There's no shortage of people telling what they want for you and what they expect from you. They're all out there. It starts with your family and your family history and your ex-family and your in-laws family and the family that you work with and your government and your community leaders and all the pressures of your various organizations. There are a whole lot of turds that won't flush that are out there that are telling you what they expect from you, for you. And if your attention is on how upsetting it is that you have to listen to and be exposed to all of these people, and that's what most of your questions are about, all of these people and all of these things that are pressures on you in this kind of a world that we live in, and there are an awful lot of expectations about what you should be doing and how your life ought to be run, and after all, you can't just go blithely through your life being what you want to be when you've got all of these other things and people and pressures telling you what you should be. And if that's where your attention is, then you will act upon what you think about, and you'll see more reason to be upset about what they want for you showing up every day. And you know, you can become immune to that. When you get to 100,000 cycles per second, after a while, you know, people say to you, you know, Wayne, I really expect that you're going to be there. This is a wedding, and this is your cousin, and after all, you should be at your cousin's wedding. And I'll say, you know, you're right about that. I really should be at my cousin's wedding if I were living at the level of consciousness that you're living at. I really should be there. But fortunately, I'm not at that level of consciousness. And I want you to really enjoy the wedding. I want you to take a lot of pictures, but don't send them to me. But you don't say it like that in a cute way or anything. You just, like you say, I understand that. And the invitations come, and you do what you want to do with the invitations. You just, you know, if you don't want to go, you don't go. And you don't tell yourself, oh, I should be there, and I have an obligation to be there, and if I'm not there, they're going to be all upset, and after all, they went to my cousin, and now it's their cousin, and these cousins, they've got to be, and like, you know, everybody, you know, 8 generations removed, we're all cousins. It means you got to go to every wedding on the planet, because we're all related. So what you do is you pick and choose, and you go where you want to go. And you're going to find that there are going to be some people out there who are not going to like your choices. But you want to know something? They respect you more. They will respect you more for being who you are, for dressing the way you want to dress, for going to the places that you want to go, for being with the people that you want to be. And you know, you learn to be a quiet warrior. Very quiet, very peaceful. You make no noise. You don't go out and shout this. The only reason I'm speaking about this is because otherwise we would have nothing on tape. And you would all come here and you'd sit here and I would say nothing. There'll come a time when you'll say, profound experience. Silence for 3 days. But you're not ready for that. And I'm not either. So I talk about it. But the way I live it out in my life, I just make the choices and implement them and do the best I can. I give the world the best I've got. And some people don't understand it and don't appreciate it. And I give the best I've got anyway. And some people, no matter how hard I try to be kind, will take advantage. So I'm just kind anyway. Just like Mother Teresa said. So the message of all of what I'm saying here is that almost everyone who has problems in their life, which are illusions, because it comes from separating from God, have problems because they have their attention on problems. And when you take your attention off of problems, even though they continue to exist, and you put your thoughts, your energy, onto what you intend to manifest into your life, and you do it quietly and peacefully. And you know something? You have to do it without telling anyone about it. Because the moment that you tell anyone about it, you invoke the ego. Because the ego insists that you explain it and defend it. And the moment you begin to explain and defend what it is that you want to attract and be in your life, problem free, the moment that you start explaining and defending that, you move your energy down into argumentation, which always weakens you, into guilt, maybe even into shame, into worry, into fear, and before you know it, in the defense and explanation of what it is that you are going to attract into your life is already been determined that it can't happen.